Talk to me.
Eat it.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
Yeah. This is like so weird. I'm posting on my weblog before I forget, right?
Did you get connected,
Alan?
At
the same time.
No, not yet.
Not yet?
No.
He's such
I'm
a
I'm having no fucking
boner.
Luck. Give me a wire, man. Give me a wire.
Hopefully I don't drool over myself. I'm on muscle relaxers, man.
He's on muscle relaxers and balls. Everybody was saying they never had any balls tonight. You know, the soft drink, so...
Everybody needs balls.
Are you connected, Pat?
Balls for
everybody.
Oh, yeah,
for a while now.
I don't know why mine's not. I'm not going to fuck with it.
Alan's just being...
Got three conversations going on over here. Link's talking about his balls. Alan's talking about his
network. Sounds like a typical tech show.
Screw this shit.
So we have intelligent listeners. They can figure it out.
Make sure you talk into the mic, Alan.
I am.
I'm going to be really anal because I'm watching this decibel meter.
That's the first problem. Don't be anal about it. Just sort of like enjoy
it. Yeah, but with the stuff we had with the logger show, that was really my fault. Number two.
Yeah, you were like super loud, but I couldn't hear anybody else. I had to keep tweaking up and down, up and down.
And I know it would... I need to turn up the really crank the volume on that. What I need is another. I need another PC, not an OS X system, because the audio recording on this thing is under Linux is shit.
We tried to hook him up, you know. Tried to hook him up to make some extra money so he could get something. And here he is over there in the chair, scratching his ass, begging for more. See, that's how it
now
works.
You know what. I will. I told you. As soon as we get the car and the debt paid off, I'm getting new systems. The wife said, "You get a new system when the car and the debt are paid off." Wait, when the car we get a car.
I was
going to
say when
off.
The debt's paid off, man, that's going to be a
no,
long
our,
time.
No, our plan is midsummer, end of summer, all our debt will be paid off. So all that gobs of money we have going out to like credit cards and loans and like other stuff is going to come back in. And we get to put it in the savings account instead of giving it to the creditors and the loan department.
Yeah, I can't get my wife to understand that concept at all. As hard as I try, she just doesn't get it. Now that we're so quiet in here, I can actually bring back my other mic, can't I?
Yeah, we can. We did. We probably should tell people that. Like, Dan moved the compact jet into the closet.
And we replaced the 3-com.
Yeah, and replaced the switch.
3-com interceptor.
Yeah.
No more. There was absolutely no stealth technology in that sucker.
No way,
Holy
man.
Holy moly.
I remember when I had a 3-com on my rack at home, the thing sounded like a jet engine. Everybody would walk by going, ah, man, your stuff is really loud. And I said, no, it's not the machine, because I had like 8 machines in there running around. No, it's not the machines, man. It's that fucking switch up there.
Like, the neighbors are like, turn down that server!
Well, dude, you look at the side of it. There's, like, what, 8 fans on each side or something like that? Holy crap, man.
And I cleaned those out today, too, man. There's, like, solid pack. Like,
I was
going to
say,
black dust.
They weren't even turning anymore.
Dude.
It was like...
Now, you know, well, here's the killer part. So how many, what was that? Is that 24 ports on that switch?
Yes.
24-port switch, right, is as big as a 1U rack unit. Okay, like a full-size 1U, almost all the way to the back rack unit for 24 ports. It's got fans lining both sides, right? The thing makes an incredible amount of noise. Now, contrast that with the new 24-port switches. I mean, I brought Dan like an old 16-port that I'm not using anymore. Has like one fan in it.
It's like a wallet compared to the other one.
it's the size of a paperback novel, okay? No noise whatsoever. See, that's what it is. We just got to, you know, we're poor Linux geeks, and we just got to get with the program and upgrade our technology a little bit. And then we can have the nice, quiet computers, too.
I was
someday.
I was in Pat's world today. As I was working on,
sounds like it should be a video.
Yeah, I was
Pat's world.
IECSS hell.
Yeah, I was at working on a new site layout, and I had all my CSS and everything all tweaked out the way I wanted it, and
looked
I'm like,
great, didn't it?
It looked well. I was looking at Firefox, and I'm like, man, I got to do the testing over in IE, and I pulled it up, and I'm like, I just think this is just going to fall apart in IE, because I had floats in there. Like, I had a float to the left and a float to the right and content in between it.
It's and just like, a jump to the left.
I was like, this is going to just destroy IE, and I was pleasantly surprised it didn't, but I did experience a problem. I had fixed the width of the page to 800 pixels by specifying the width of the body being 800 pixels, and then I had a header in there, a header tag, a div that was with a class of a header, and then my main body section. What I noticed that IE does, or it actually doesn't do, which it should, is it doesn't, I don't think it considers the body as a block element. Because I applied the width to 800 pixels to the body tag, and it didn't adjust that for other elements. If I didn't specify the width of like the header, it put it out all the way to the length of the page. It made it like 100% of the length of the page, regardless of how large the page was. So whereas Firefox stopped it at the 800 pixels, in IE it just kept going until it filled the screen.
Awesome.
So I had to specify 800 pixel width for that. And then for my main body section, I had to create another div in there for the main content and specify that width also, because all the content was falling out of the frame, out of the width of the page that it was supposed to be. So once I did that, it all looked fine. And I was like, wow, I cannot believe that it didn't really fall apart in Internet Explorer. Such is the case. Right, Pat?
Right.
Fun stuff. You gonna be okay there?
The share's not cutting it.
What?
The share's not cutting it. I'm gonna stand.
Would the cushion chair cut it a little better?
Maybe.
Fallon, we switch chairs
right.
with you?
It's all right, man. Let me stand.
Why don't you lay on the ground?
Yeah.
And open the door. Let the dog in, too.
Oh, that would be hilarious.
All right, so everybody else was having problems this week, right? Now, let me tell you my problem.
Wait, we got a good thing.
Oh, well, go. Good things are good. Well, we did have a good, because, you know, I brought Dan cables. I brought Dan freaking, a new switch.
Yeah, you brought me this cable that'll wrap around my neighborhood, man.
He said he wanted a long cable, right? I've been holding on to this one cable for
six years.
My wife's
got my Slurpee. I can't believe you guys didn't want Slurpees. Shame on you.
Rolling on this cable for 6 years, man. The thing is so long, you could literally wrap it around Dan's house, I bet, three times. But he said he needed a long cable so that he could, plug his server into the closet or whatever. So I was like, all right, I know just a cable.
So, what happened was when I moved it into the closet, I'm like, I got these cables.
He can braid it and still get it to fit.
I got these cables, and I'm thinking about running them across the wall. And then I was like, well, what happens if the power goes out and I need to get over into the server? Because it's got two problems. One is there's no monitor on it.
Right.
I have no monitor in there to see it. And then I got to make sure that I'd be able to pull it all the way over here to attach it to the KVM so I could put it in the monitor. Unless I get a really long VGA cable, which I might be able to do that.
I don't have one of them.
So I could do that. Because this afternoon, the power went out and the server went down. So I had to go over there and pull it out of the closet, bring it over here.
Man.
Well, that's why that little red light on the UPS flashes so that you replaced the battery.
Yeah, I know, but that was a discarded UPS. I got to buy a new one. I hate UPSs, man. We had one that blew out at work. Not blew out, but the battery went. Mm-hmm. So I went and I ordered another one, and I'm sitting there squinting at the price list and the PDF, and I'm like, okay. And I put down RC24. And it ordered it, and it should have been RC23.
Oh, dude.
So I bring everything down and over the weekend, and I put the new battery in, and I'm trying to plug it in. I'm like, what the hell? What the hell? So, I can't get out to the network because the main switch is down. Because every time we have a power outage, it pulls down the switch because the UPS doesn't work. The Cisco switch keeps losing its configuration and won't boot properly, so you have to go manually boot it. And it's the school that's the furthest away, too. It's like in the ass end of nowhere. So I got a new UPS battery. It doesn't work. And I'm like, why the hell isn't this thing working? So I had to put the old battery in, plug it in, so I can get back on the network so I can download the price list to find out what's going on. That's when I realized I was one number off. And I'm like, sons of gods. Here we go. And then I called the company to talk about how I can get it, you know, send it back, because it goes through, like, something called Pepm. So I don't order it directly from APC. I order it through some, like, consortium. So I call them up, and I'm like, well, I ordered it through this consortium, but you're the guy, your company shipped it to me, but you're not APC. How do I get it replaced? Well, we'll take down your number, and I'll find out how to actually do this, and we'll call you back. I haven't heard from them yet. That was 2 days ago. Anyway, Richard Houston had sent us an email of an important project out there concerning the LTSP project, the Linux Terminal Server project.
Yes,
has a Frapper map, and which is listing all the LTSP projects in use that are aware of the Frapper map. So, you know, we're putting out a word out there. If you know of an LTSP project, if you're running one, hey, plug it into the Frapper map over there. Check it out at www.k12ltsp.com or www.ltsp.org and plug in your pin in the Frapper map. Now, Link, you can talk about your important stuff.
Oh, well, my important stuff, my shitty week. I know Pat has a shitty week because he pulled a hamstring. He's, like, gimping around. I started my week in the beginning of the weekend by chipping a portion of my tooth off, which is great fun. What,
by chipping rocks.
And I can only get it temporarily fixed and filled until I get back from going to Boston for LWE, and then I chipped it again today. That drives me nuts.
What'd you chip it on?
Believe it or not,
a hot dog.
Today I chipped it on a tuba.
A tuba?
Yeah. On a tuba.
He was at home practicing his polka.
Believe it or not,
I'm sure his neighbors love him.
My kid, like, one of the stipulations of, you know, like, being my kid is that I wanted her to take an instrument because I believe, and rightly so, that taking an instrument makes you smarter. You know, it teaches you math a little bit better. You have to learn fractions because of the time, and, you know, I don't know. You can look it up if you don't believe me, but it really does. It makes you a smarter person if you take an instrument. So I told her she had to take an instrument, and she's been taking flute for quite a while now, and she also, for marching band, they switched her to piccolo, right? Well, evidently, she's in middle school now, and evidently all the low brass players, the tuba players specifically, are graduating this year. She just got into middle school, so she got next year, too. So all the tuba players are graduating this year, and I guess the music teacher is looking hard to get some kind of replacement people to play tuba, and my daughter volunteered. So now she's playing piccolo and tuba. And I had to... You suck, Dan. I had to drag this thing home today.
There are no fans.
And I just happened to... Like, I just happened to be an old semi-pro low brass player from years and years ago, and I haven't touched a tuba in 15, 20 years. Anyway, I had to pick it up today and play my, you know, B-flat scale and stuff like that and get it working to impress my kid. And, like, one of the first things I did was bring it up to my face and smash the frickin' mouthpiece right into my damn chip tooth.
Nice.
Oh, break another little corner off. Son of a gun. But actually, you know, the little corner I broke off was the corner that has been poking my frickin' lip all week anyway, so piss on it.
Well, so what's left of your tooth?
It's all there. It's just missing a little tiny corner. And I gotta get it, like, they're gonna, like, get the impact hammer out, and they're going to drill all of it out and fill it up. And
they just yank all your teeth out and give you dentures.
Dude, I already had one tooth.
Dude, did you ever hear about that guy who did his own dentistry by getting pebbles out of his driveway and he'd grind them down into the shape of a tooth, and he'd rip out his tooth and put the pebble in?
Get out of here.
Now, yeah, yeah, what show was that on?
Yeah, I don't understand that one there. How sick do you have to be?
It was long after...
Holy crap, man. I had one tooth pulled. They had to get in there with a jackhammer, right? This little tiny dentist, like a month ago. Little tiny dentist and her assistant crawls into my mouth with a jackhammer to pull this tooth out. I cannot imagine doing that myself.
Yeah, he had his whole little home dentistry thing set up. Did you, when they pulled the tooth, did they stick that thing up there and crack it? You had to...
Oh, hell yeah. They had to break it in like 15 different pieces, and then they had to go drilling around down in there to get everything out.
So. Did you see it when they pulled it out?
No.
I looked at mine I wanted to see him when they pulled them out.
No, all I saw was my dentist tit. The whole time.
And it was a man.
No, it was a girl. But like every time.
Was she hot?
I don't know. All I saw was the boob, right?
But was that good?
I don't know. Every time I, because you know they're right on you, right? And she's just a little thing, so like she's all, you know, crawled up on top of my head, and she says, turn your head towards me, please. So you turn your head towards her.
Turn your head and cough.
And all you got is boob in your face, right? And I try to be like polite about this, and so I move my head back a little bit and start turning it back away. No, as soon as you do that, she just grabs my head again, says, turn your head towards me, please. So, you know, there I was with my...
And then you passed out and woke up and your butt hurts.
The whole
time. You were laying in the alley.
Yeah. Now, that's when I sleep over Dan's house, that happens.
There were stray cats laying.
You'll wake up with Vaseline all over your ass? Would you tell anybody?
Oh, shit.
Sick bastard.
I got a tub of Vaseline for whoever's staying with me in the room.
No, I'm staying with Alan.
I'm staying with Alan.
Room to myself. Oh.
So, you know, I've had some dental problems lately. I'm hoping to get them resolved soon, especially even sooner now since I think my new insurance kicks in on the 1st of next month, but. Yeehaw!
Let's see here. LWE next week.
Yeah.
We got the banner.
Oh, where are the pads, man?
The pads are right there in the box.
Pull one of them out for me, Pat.
The maxi pads?
Yeah.
Did we finally get
I want to tell everybody about them, but I want to have it in my hand to describe it, right?
What about the t-shirts?
They haven't come yet. However, they're slated to be delivered... by the 31st.
Oh, got them. Nice. Cool, man.
All right, here's what we got. We got t-shirts that are supposed to be here, right? Like, they better be here because they charge me money for them. And we also have some chill packs.
Yeah, buddy
that,
Dean Hagman.
Dean hooked us up with, man.
Are they autographed?
And they are indeed autographed.
Awesome.
Autographed chill packs from our buddy Dean.
Awesome, man. Dean,
you
rock.
He hooked this up. He is the
You are
dude.
The man.
One I'm holding in my hand now says,
listening.
Stay cool but from he is Dean Hagley.
He's a cool freaking guy, man.
He's the guy, I'm telling you, man.
Very down-earth person, man. Cool guy.
Gotta love him. Gotta love him. He hooked this up good, man. That's really cool.
How many
cool.
did they give us? 5 or 10?
I think they gave us like 10.
Cool. We'll be raffling those off then.
Well, they might have been 5. I don't know. You have to look in the box and count them.
Yeah.
He said he'd send 5 or 10. I don't know how many he sent, but either way,
and,
do it in my hand right now. I'm holding an autographed Dean Hagman chill pack.
And we got DVDs and CDs.
Yep, we got
CDs.
DVDs
we're giving away
CDs.
The DVDs we're taking $2 donations.
Are we going to give some DVDs away as raffle prizes, or are we just going to raffle off those?
I think we should just raffle off the chill packs. Raffle the chill packs off and maybe some shirts or something, unless somebody's like really special and they need to get one, because we didn't buy a lot. They cost a whole freaking lot of money, dude.
Six. It's 6 in here plus that one's 7.
That's 7.
Dan probably pawned the other 3 off.
He probably stole them.
No, that's, I didn't touch
fucking
any
bastard.
Of them.
Alright, I gave us 7 then.
That's probably all that fits in the
and here's
box,
something,
right?
I was thinking about. If I can get a laptop, you know, borrow a laptop from work, I could take Dynabolic. And if we're going to have a mixer there, we could probably stream Wednesday
right.
night.
Keep dreaming, dude.
No, out of the hotel.
No way. We're not going to have bandwidth to do that, man.
Keep
you don't
dreaming.
Think so?
Nope.
We could try it.
I don't think it'll happen. Because remember, we had last time we went down there, we had a really hard time streaming, or not even streaming, just getting all 4 of us connected. Remember?
Yeah.
And staying connected. So I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, it was worth a shot. Did you order any Bash? No Bash Powder t-shirts, right? It was all... That's all you got. Where instead of the Tech Show t-shirts, it's all Bash Powder.
No, I got two Bash Powder shirts for myself, and they are up on the store, though. So, like, if you go to our website and hit the store, you can order one, you know. They're kind of cool. You'll see them. But I ordered a couple of them, and I got another Tech Show shirt for myself, the regular Tech Show t-shirts that we have on the storefront, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, I had, like, Tech Show gear for the entire time we were there. Want to represent, you know what I mean? I don't know what we're going to do with Alan, but I think we're going to strip him naked, and we're going to paint a Tech Show logo on him.
From last year.
Oh, he's going to wear... Alan's going to show his...
Hey, I found those Tech Show stickers Pat gave me on the floor over here.
Alan's
going to
show his support by wearing a button.
And I'm going to stick a sticker on there, too, since... It won't be professional, but it'll be us.
Porn-fessional.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so I think we're good, and I hope to hell that we do get the shipment of t-shirts on time. I really will be irritated if we don't.
Wouldn't that suck if they came the day after we left?
Big money, so.
Yeah, how much do I owe you?
You owe me. I'll look while we continue the show.
Will four Tech Show stickers cover it?
I don't think that's going to cut it, man.
All right, five.
Not this time.
I need to put one of these somewhere. Put it right in the square in the middle of my monitor. I like those stickers.
They're nice stickers, man.
I need to stick them on. So here we go.
There's no bout to doubt it.
Let's make it official. This is now the official Tech Show sound card.
Pretty, man.
Right there. It's not a sound blaster anymore. It's a Tech Show blaster. Because it blasts the hell out of our stinking audio. And it makes it sound like crap. Woohoo!
Yeah, buddy.
Our guest is on. Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Excellent.
We've got Brad Bowling, a patent attorney with Baker Botts.
Can you hear Pat?
Yeah, actually I can.
Oh, all right, for once.
Hey, I notice most of the time the guests can't hear him at all.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
I think they just ignore him because he's annoying.
I don't think it has to do with the asterisks, though.
No, it's probably the crappy mics I use.
There's rumor out there that the certain phone companies like Verizon don't like Pat, so they mess with his voice.
They're blocking it.
Shit happens.
That new technology, right?
Yeah, he's not getting...
I generally thought the problem was that his voice is outside the range of human hearing.
I don't have a radio voice. It's pretty bad.
He's always talking out his ass.
That's what it is. The mic is in the wrong place. Now we know. Quick, Pat, bend over. Let's fix that.
Oh, that's not nice.
Never mind.
You're lucky I'm on muscle relaxers tonight.
Funny. Yeah, he'd kick me with his good leg.
All right, so we're gonna get an excellent education tonight.
Okay.
Now, Brad, you're a Tech Show listener, aren't you?
I am. I try to download the show and listen to it on the weekends generally. I enjoy it quite a bit. I love that you guys are always trying out new apps. In general, I run Linux, but it runs pretty stable for me, so I'm never trying out new stuff and. I like you guys going out there and trying out new stuff for me.
We aim to please.
Do all my grunt work. Hey, that's cool. So anyway, should we talk some patents?
Yeah, let's talk some patents, because, you know, from what I understand, there's a whole lot of stuff I don't understand about patents.
Right. If you read, Slashdot, I mean, there's so many misconceptions out there about the way the patent system works. And I think hopefully we can get the listeners on this show a little more educated, a little more up to speed about how the patent system works. So I created some tiny URL links for tonight so listeners can play along at home, and you guys too. The example patent is the famous Microsoft FAT patent. And the URL to look at the text of the patent is going to be tinyurl.com/xrayvictorgs. So anyway, the theory behind the patent system is that whenever you come up with an invention in this country, you are always entitled to just keep it secret. Okay, not tell anybody about it. You can exploit it for commercial gain or whatever. What's interesting, though, is that they said, okay, we're going to have a patent system. And the patent system's a deal. What it is that in exchange for you disclosing how to practice your invention, you get what are called claims. And claims define the meets and bounds of your invention. Now, in land, you think about meets and bounds as like a bunch of plots of land sitting one next to the other. In patents, the way it works is that basically you should think about it like concentric circles or some kind of concentric shape. If you're the first in a field, you're going to get this big circle that covers a whole bunch of technology. And then as more and more people enter the field, what you have to do is you have to be within one of the existing circles. So let's take a look at, are you actually able to look at the patent that I cited?
I'm pulled it up right now.
Okay.
And you, your common namespace for long, short, and short file names, right?
Right. All right. So this is what's affectionately known as the FAT patent. And the drafting on the claims here is a little strange, but in general, the Microsoft attorneys do a pretty good job. So the claims are really the only part of the patent that matter from a legal rights point of view. Okay, a lot of times what will happen is on Slashdot, somebody will go, oh, Microsoft patented double-clicking, because they'll be looking at the abstract. The abstract is part of the disclosure, and the disclosure's there because of the other part of the deal, that you have to disclose to the public how to practice your invention. The part that matters to you as a property rights holder are these claims. These claims, in this case, it's a computer system and a series of steps. Okay. Now, if you want to sue somebody for patent infringement, you have to prove that they perform every single one of these steps. If they just do all but one of them, or you know, if they just do one of them, they do not infringe on your patents, and you're not going to win against them. So, So, like I was saying, when you have normal property, think about it as you know, a bunch of houses or plots of land laid out next to each other. But with patents, you're always patenting within what somebody else has done before. So, for example, if you have the first car, you know, your claim would say a car. It really wouldn't be that simple or whatever. It might be, you know, like a chassis, four wheels, a couple axles. You can talk about how they're connected together. Then, if you're going to be the second person, say you invent the car with the horn, you include all of the claim elements that were there for the car, and you add in and a horn. So, you would be novel over the car because you've created a car with a horn. You guys following me so far?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, in general, to be able to get a patent, your invention, as embodied in your claims, which is the number of things we're looking at up here.
You said they have to do all of this crap?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm looking at this thing now. It's huge. There's 28 items in there, and then some of them are, you know, have sub-items underneath them.
Oh, okay. Maybe I didn't make that clear enough. What they have to do, you only have to infringe on one claim.
Oh.
Okay. Now, the claim, if you look at claim one, it has A, B, C, elements.
And D. Okay. And E.
And E. Yeah, but it's not. There's
am I looking at the wrong pen?
The D and E are under the C one. They're like inclusive in the C one.
And the patent office.
Now, are you saying they have to infringe on only one of these claims or one of the sub claims?
Okay, you have to. The numbered things are each claim. To be able to sue somebody for patent infringement, they're going to have to perform every step in one of the numbered claims. So, and what's nice is that it really doesn't matter how many of their claims that the infringer infringes on, as long as they infringe on one of the claims. So, claim one, basically it's stuck. Even though it's called the fat patent, it's not really fat. Fat was around since the 70s, so there wouldn't be a valid patent on it anymore. What this was directed to is, it's essentially a hack, to have long file names under DOS's fat operating system. So, yeah, if you read through the disclosure, the way they do it is that they'll have a short file name with basically a special character in it, which, if you remember DOS, it's always a tilde, which tells it to go over and look at the next entry in the directory list. And that'll start having the long file name, and you can chain a bunch of these together. So basically Microsoft came up with a way to do this and was able to patent it. But and you'd be surprised, a lot of really, dare I say, good patents are really hacks. So some of them better than others, but in general, as we say in patent law, all of technology is very incremental. You know, the light bulb just didn't come out of anywhere. There were tons of patents dealing with things like that before. Everything you do is very small. The only requirement is that what you're claiming has to be novel. And in patent law, novel just means that you don't have a single prior art reference that does every single element of your claim. And it also has to be non-obvious, which is very fuzzy. Because to be non-obvious, it's not going to be obvious to a person of ordinary skill in the art in view of the prior art. I'm going to get more into what constitutes prior art later. But that's generally the requirement for having your claims allowed. But so you have at least E elements here that the infringer has to perform in order to infringe on the first claim. Now, if you notice, claim two is what's called a deep. Okay, claim one is called an independent claim. It stands by itself. Claim two is what's called a dependent claim. Basically, it incorporates all of the requirements of claim one plus an extra requirement. So in this case, the extra requirement is that the long file name contains more characters than the short file name.
That almost sounds obvious, but I guess is it possible to have a long file name? I'm sorry, actually I was laughing there, but is it possible to have a long file name with less characters than the short file name?
I really don't think so.
It's kind of...
I think we should patent it. What do you think?
We should. That'd be perfect.
Hey, didn't Donald Trump trademark you fired?
You know, that's actually a common misconception. Oh, maybe that's another thing I should go into. The difference between patent, trademark, and copyright. Trademark really has nothing to do with inventions. Trademark protects marks, which can be spoken or in rare cases. Most time it's a written mark with some kind of styling. For use in commerce. And the idea of trademark is really a consumer protection thought. What you want to do is that, say that you've created some kind of brand that has a certain trade or service mark, and consumers have come to associate your trade or service mark with what we call a source of good. So it doesn't have to do with the good itself, but rather that they know that it comes from you, and presumably, you impart some quality to it because you have some kind of reputation. So, trademarks really are definitely not there to protect inventions. It's more of a consumer protection stuff. Copyright, let's talk about that a little bit. Copyright's pretty poorly misunderstood, it's well misunderstood. Copyright in the United States, and pretty much internationally, it's going to protect any work that's fixed in a tangible medium. Okay? You have copyright automatically as a matter of law anytime you write something. Like after you've created a piece of code, you have copyright in it. And you could sue people who make copies of it or infringe on some of your other copyright rights. The big thing that gets you in open source, though, software, since you're not charging money for your software, that in general you would have no damages because you wouldn't have realized any profit off selling it yourself. But So if you go through what's called copyright registration, which is a fairly easy process, basically you're going to submit the first 15 and last 15 pages of your source code to the Copyright Office. You can get what's called statutory damages, which I actually don't know the number. I don't practice much copyright litigation. But you can get a fixed fee for every copy that an infringer makes. So there's basically four different regimes of intellectual property in America. You have patents, which are probably the most complex, in that there's a long process to draft a patent and get it to the patent office. Copyright, which happens automatically. Trademark, which also happens automatically. As soon as you start using a mark in commerce, meaning that you put a sign out front of your shop, you have trademark rights by using it in commerce. Now, there's also a trademark registration system in America that'll help you preserve your rights nationally. The fourth regime of intellectual property is trade secret, which is almost exclusively governed by state law. But generally, if you have some kind of knowledge that gives you some kind of competitive advantage in business, and you take active measures to keep it secret, and somebody goes out and misappropriates it to another party, then you can sue them for taking your trade secret. That's purely a creature of state law, though. There's no federal trade secret statute. So most of my practice deals with patents, and there's actually a lot of geeks in patent law because especially those of us that draft patent applications and get them to the PTO, it's one of my favorite things to do, to go out and interview inventors, figure out what their invention is, and then write it into a patent and get it through the patent office. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but as an engineer, often it's like you don't need to know everything. You know, you only need to know enough to do your job. What's nice as a patent lawyer is that you need to know everything in order to write a patent on, you know, on any given invention. And I really like knowing everything, so works out well for me.
So you have to do a lot of research on your end.
Not so much, really. I deal with the same technologies quite a bit over and over, and so I know a lot of what's out there. And then the best resource for really specific areas of technology is going to be the inventors themselves. They're working in the field all day. They know, you know, who's invented what the other company is probably working on, what their capabilities are. So they're the best resource for figuring out what that they're doing is new.
Okay.
It's always fun to work with engineers.
So then when we bring this back then to the fat patent that you started with, so essentially, Microsoft has its patent lawyers, and between the engineers and the patent lawyers, there's been enough research to verify that this should be a legitimate patent, and then they send it to the patent office.
Now, let me actually clarify that. You don't have to do any research before you file a patent application. You can claim the moon and submit it as a patent application, and that's fine. It's up to the patent office to do an examination to figure out if what you're claiming is, in fact, novel and non-obvious.
Okay, so that's why we have all these ridiculous patents on things now. So basically, I could claim the moon as a patent, and it would go through, because I'm sure I just read somewhere that they were complaining, the patent office workers were complaining how overworked they were and stuff like that, and they don't have time to research anything. And
they're government employees, man. They probably paid not that much.
So what's it going to cost for me to get you to write a patent for me so that I can patent the Earth and start making some money? We have to be real detailed and specific here.
Exactly.
You know?
So then is what going...
Let me take those. So anyway, you're talking about how the problems with the examiners right now. There are far too few examiners. The backlog of pending patents has been rising for years and years because there's just not enough examiners to look at them all. So there is huge pressure within the patent office to get the examiners to go through patents as quickly as possible. And it's not good for anyone involved, because first of all, sometimes you will get patents that contain claims that are invalid, and that will later get invalidated in court. Second of all, a lot of my day is spent arguing with examiners who have just made like really bad objections. Like what they'll do is they'll look at your claim language and do some kind of text search and just find, you know, some patents that happen to contain some of the same words. And it doesn't work out well for anyone. So the patent office definitely needs to hire more examiners. Telling the truth, it is not their fault. The patent office is one of the few government agencies that makes money. They make a lot of money every year, and Congress typically raids it at the end of the year. So the patent office may have a surplus of, say, you know, like $500 million. And Congress says, oh, thank you very much, and takes it away from them. The patent office should be able to use that money to hire more examiners, but they haven't been able to, because it's just such a huge cash cow for the government. So it is a sad state of affairs. Hopefully it'll get better. We will see. Not holding my breath. In general, most people you talk to hold the European patent examiners in the highest regard. They typically have more time to do better searching. They're typically better educated and far more knowledgeable on the topics they work in. So for a really good patent examination, you should go to the EPO, which is the European Patent Office. But I have immense respect for the U.S. examiners, too. They typically do a very good job.
So then getting back to this fat patent that we're talking about, we've addressed that you only need to violate one of the claims in here. And what is the misconception about patents that you keep seeing on places like Slashdot or Dig? Or what is the community not getting? Like, what am I not getting about patents?
I think the biggest problem is most of the time, they're not looking at the claims at all. They're looking at the abstracts. They'll quote the abstract and say, oh, well, the abstract says this and this and this. You know, it talks about double-clicking. And they'll be like, oh, no, we're not allowed to double-click anymore or whatever. And that's just generally not the way it works for infringement. You have to perform all the elements of one of these claims. And then that's generally what people aren't looking at right now.
So then,
you have to perform all the elements of the claim, or you have to violate one of the elements that's in the claim, one of the claims?
You have to perform all of the elements of the claim to infringe on it.
So then, in the case of the fat patent, claim number one, if you perform A, B, C, D, and E, you have violated the patent.
Right. You're then infringing on the patent.
What if you only do A, B, and C?
And
have you violated
not infringed on
that? Yeah, so I have to do every one of those, right?
Yeah, you have to do every one of those. I mean, there's very minor exceptions.
In any one claim, right?
Yeah, in any one claim.
So then, based upon this claim,
mm-hmm.
and your knowledge of Linux or operating systems who implement VFAT, does Linux violate this claim?
The way I understand it, currently by supporting FAT with the extended names, I think it does, assuming that you support both reading and writing. And I've only given this a quick look. This is not a legal opinion. This is my personal opinion. And so, I mean, the claim is fairly scary. But I think it will read on most implementations of performing the FAT with the extended file names. If you're just using the old 8x3 file names, it would not infringe.
So again, I guess one of the issues that people had brought to light is that this technology existed before Microsoft's implementation of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, in your knowledge, know if it did exist prior to Microsoft implementing?
You know, it really doesn't look like it did. So, in what happens, you file your patent application, and the examiner almost always is going to reject it, throw some art at you that he's able to find. And in the end, you're either going to, you might have to do what's called amending your claims, which is changing them so that they get around the prior art that's cited, or sometimes you'll have to abandon it if you simply have no invention there. Microsoft has gone through examination twice. So they went through that initial examination where they got this patent, and then they went through what's called a re-examination. And these are fairly rare procedures. You're talking about 1% or less of all issued patents go through re-exams. But I guess, what is it, the PubPat Foundation filed a re-exam request, sent in a whole bunch of art, including 96, ISO 9660 was submitted, Rock Ridge, and then another patent. Basically, all three of those were doing things a little differently. But those were probably the closest pieces of prior art that were out there. And you can look at the entire prosecution history that they went through to get to that. I have another link for it. It's long and convoluted, though. But so the patent office has looked at all of this cited art and basically said that the Microsoft implementation is both novel and non-obvious in light of all that cited art. So the odds on being able to break this patent in the future appear to be slim to none. If there had been... See, this is one of the really great things about having open source software, is that if you're trying to fight a software patent, you can go back and look at, you know, old versions of file systems, old versions of the kernel itself, to see when they were implementing the feature. And what's nice is that, you know, source code doesn't lie. It's either doing it or it's not. It's not really open to interpretation. So it's great to have open source software out there to bust patents. And I would have figured if there was an open source implementation that was doing the hack that Microsoft is claiming, the PubPat would have cited it. But they didn't. All they had cited were these publications, and none of them appeared to knock out the claims. So Microsoft got off very well in this, and the patent's going to be very hard to bust in the future.
So in your research, obviously you've looked into this patent, am I not mistaken?
I looked into it a little bit, yeah.
Now, when did they originally file for this patent? Is that visible?
All right, now, this is where it's going to get confusing. Scroll down. Because the actual filing date of this patent is... Okay, let me back up. The filing date of this patent is up at the top, and you'll see that it says May 26, 1998. That is the filing date of this patent. There's another thing in patent law that's called the priority date. So one patent application might not necessarily come to fruition as a patent. What you can do is file a series of patent applications where you can continue to argue with the examiner, you can modify your claims or whatever. So that's what happened in this case. If you go down past the claims and past the cited references to patent case text, the priority date on this patent is going to be April 1, 1993. That is the oldest grandparent of the application that issued as this patent.
Okay, so
basically, that thing that Mike.
No, go ahead.
So basically, what the deal is that you're entitled to the earliest date for priority on your patent of when you made the disclosure of how to practice the claims. That becomes an issue in a lot of cases where you made a partial disclosure and you updated it later. Da 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 da. Here, the disclosure's been the same throughout the life of the application that issues this patent. Oh my bad, it's up above the claims where it talks about the file history here. But basically, they're able to claim back to April 1st, 1993.
Okay, so they have a claim back to April 1st, 1993, but the patent. Now, this patent, has it been approved?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it is not only... like I said, it got issued as a patent in 98, and then it went back into re-examination, I guess it was last year, and it came out of re-examination almost unchanged. There were a few minor changes to the claims, but nothing that really changed the scope of that.
So then we have this has been a patented technology from Microsoft since 1998, but the patent applies all the way back to 1993.
Well, you can't sue anybody on your patent, generally, until the patent, you can't sue anybody on the patent until it issues. What that priority date is useful for is that when people come and they're trying to bust your patent, you want to have the earliest priority date possible, because they're going to be coming with articles, with software, testimony of other possible inventors, and the date that they have to beat is going to be based on your priority date. So, for example, if they have an article that describes some implementation that falls within your claims, it has to be 1 year before your priority date.
Okay.
There's other situations.
So, can Microsoft sue on this patent now, as of 1998,
yes.
Or was it as of 2005?
1998. Re-exam is a strange procedure, but re-exam just means the patent office is looking at the patent again. As long as the patent is in re-examination, it is still a valid patent and can be sued on. So you saw this in the BlackBerry case, right? The BlackBerry case, the patent went back in re-examination, and here's a little tip. Everyone gets real excited because the patent office is always going to issue a rejection immediately after it goes into re-examination. That's because the standard to have the patent office re-examine a patent is that there's a substantial issue of patentability. So, like PubPat or somebody like that is going to submit a whole bunch of articles and a whole bunch of explanation explaining why the patent is invalid in light of the prior art. So, if the patent office says yes, because a lot of times they're going to say, no, you have not raised a substantial issue of patentability, go away. If they do grant a re-exam, though, their first action is always going to be to issue a rejection. Generally, you get two or three go-arounds with the examiner, right, where you'll argue, they'll give you a rejection, you'll argue some more, maybe you'll change the claim, they'll reject you again. You know, if they don't allow it, then they'll make it final, and you have to appeal it to, it's called the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences, which is, it's not really a court, it's an administrative procedure within the patent office. After that, you can appeal to the Court of Appeals, and after that, you can appeal to the Supreme Court. Not until you lose in the Supreme Court will your patent be ripped down on re-exam. So, but the RIM patents are still very, or the NTP patents are still very much valid, even though they're in re-exam and have been finally rejected. It's not until, that they've exhausted all their appeals that the patents will be canceled, if they are.
Okay. So now, the patent has been approved as of 1998. We got it going back to 1993. So let's just say, theoretically, based upon claim, one of these claims, Linux kernel violates this patent based upon any one of these claims here. Now, if Microsoft were to come after Linux and try and sue based upon that patent, would they be allowed to sue just one entity, or would they then have to if they're going to enforce their patent against, like, Linux, would they have to enforce it against everybody? Camera makers, flash card makers.
Okay. When you have a patent, you have the right to make, use, sell, and offer to sell your claimed invention. Okay. Anybody who does one of those things that violates one of your claims can be sued. You can sue anybody you want to. It doesn't matter. Generally, you're going to want to go after the person with money. So, I mean, that's the whole reason SCO sued IBM and didn't go after Linus. Because, in general, you're right into the patent. You can exclude people. So you can get injunctions against them practicing on your patent. You can also ask for damages. In general, you're more interested in damages. the whole thing with open source violating patents, I mean, the big question there is, you know, who are you going to sue? Are they going to have any money? And to the extent that they're not even in America, will you be able to enforce it? Because the U.S. patent law only applies in America. That you've got to be practicing all of these elements inside the country.
Well, intellectual patenting and reverse engineering of software?
See, okay. So, reverse engineering was good when you could only get copyrights on software. Okay? Because copyright's going to protect against copying of the software itself. If you reverse engineer software and it still infringes on the patent, even if you've never even looked at the source code, as long as it violates one or performs all the steps of one of these claims, you're still liable for patent infringement.
So you're patenting a thought process, almost like I could patent hammering, you know, hammering a nail.
As long as there's some kind of tangible output, you're not allowed to patent pure algorithms. But if you have software that uses the algorithm to do something, you can patent that.
See, that's ridiculous. When are they going to can that shit? Because that's ridiculous, man.
Hey, what are you talking about? That's how I make a living.
You can make a living, you know, doing other kinds of patents too, right?
Yeah. I mean, this was something I'd hope we get into. I know there is a lot of animosity out there towards patent law on software.
That's really shitty,
but,
man.
You know? But why is it any different than having patents on anything else?
Because it's encumbering free thought, I think. You know what I mean? Now you're patenting ideas from my head, kind of a thing, or patenting ideas from your head that I might also have, is what it amounts to.
So you really can't patent the idea. You have to have some kind of implementation of it to be able.
Yeah,
to
but I mean that's the general outcome of an idea. It has some implementation somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, generally speaking, if you have the idea that you're going to walk down the street, eventually it's going to happen. You know, so I should be able to patent the idea of walking down my sidewalk in front of my house and all the processes involved. You know, you walk out your front door, you walk to the sidewalk, you know, you hang a right or a left, you walk down the sidewalk, you put one foot in front of the other. There, I have patented walking. You know, I mean, it's ludicrous. It's a bad business plan kind of thing. Bad implementation of it. You know what I mean?
Well, no, it's probably done before. I mean, to the extent you have investment in it. Like in general, people don't have a problem with patenting pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
The pharmaceutical research is really non-inventive in a lot of ways. It is a lot of trial and error. You spend a ton of money on it. You have to do a ton of trial and error.
Sure.
But in general, there's not a lot of thought put into it. Whereas when you look at some software patents, you will get some, you know, you got some clever hacks. You got some good stuff that you're spending R&D on. And that, you know, actually took a lot of effort to come up with. Why shouldn't you be entitled to a patent on that? Now, if you're going to tell me you're not entitled to patents on anything, that's a fine position to take. And you can take that up with Congress. But the extent that we're going to have patents, why not allow patents on software?
Because as a programmer, I can tell you there aren't that many ways to come up with some things. You know what I mean? Like, it's entirely possible for...
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, but you would be surprised, too. It's entirely possible for, you know, in a room full of 20 programmers that are tasked with doing the same thing to come up with the exact same code.
How many ways,
you know,
can, how many ways can you code a for loop, you know?
Yeah, like, if you're doing PHP 4 and you've tasked 30 people with writing a Hello World program, chances are you're going to get a couple of them that are going to have the same damn program.
Right. I think in that case, what you're talking about is that the solution is obvious to the person of ordinary, or what we call the person of ordinary skills, so it would not be patentable. You still have to be both novel over everything that's out there and non-obvious. So to the extent you're coming up with obvious solutions,
you don't think like double-clicking would be an obvious thing? I mean, if one click don't do, you have to use two, right? Or would they jump right from like... single clicking to triple clicking or something like that. You know what I mean? They, like, this is the kind of thing I'm running into. I'm trying to figure out how they're getting patents on some of these things that I think personally are really, really obvious.
Right. That's an interesting problem, because in general, when the examiners reject you, obviousness is a tough rejection to make. And they need to have documentary evidence. And there's a lot of things that are done that just aren't well documented, that if they had better documentation, and especially if they go to open source code, they would have a much easier job rejecting. Because mm-hmm. In general, everyone I work for, you know, I mentioned some really thought out, you know, programs and systems and stuff like that. And I don't have any problems getting patents for them. I mean, I have seen some bad patents out there. What's interesting, though, is that no one has been able to find something that really busts the Amazon one-click patent, which some people hold up as like being an awful patent. But if you actually read the claims of it, it's fairly detailed. You have to go through quite a few steps to infringe on it. Barnes & Noble did all those steps.
How can there be quite a few steps to infringe on double-clicking?
No, one-click.
No, on the Amazon one-click patent.
Okay. I was going to say, how the hell do you... It's pretty much two steps, right? Click once, click again.
That's too technical.
All right, well, let me...
I think there's at least seven claim out.
let me take another...
Go on.
Let me take another viewpoint here, okay? Just looking at this patent claim and reading through some of the claims in here, it seems that it makes it really, really, really difficult to even begin to approach similar technology or a novel implementation of this that wouldn't violate the claim. And in thinking on those lines, it seems to me, as a non-Microsoft user, as a Linux user, as, you know, anything else but Microsoft, I look at this and I say, well, wait a minute. You know, this was approved in 1998, and since then, we've had a whole slew of applications and hardware that has implemented the technology in this claim. And what that says to me is, as a Linux user, I can't partake of that technology without violating the claim. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Back in 1998, when this was approved, we kind of let the barn door open and all our livestock got out. Because now we're stuck in a position where, you know, all these cameras, all these flash devices all support this technology that, if we implement it, violates the claim. And that's, you know, a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, but not just that. Like, you just brought up that point about, it's hard to even come close to doing that, you know, whatever it is, to doing that portion of technology, because it's so carefully worded. But doesn't that now make it extremely difficult for any innovation to happen in that area as well? Because you can't violate any one point of the patent
without
violating the patent. So you can't then improve upon it either, unless you're the patent holder, right?
No, definitely not. You've had plenty of file system innovation after this. You definitely don't have. In fact, you'd be a fool to try. This is a hack. This is a hack by Microsoft. Why would you want to, you know, use
no, but
them
I,
to try to?
Yeah, but I mean, this particular example of the file system aside, you know, what about something like double clicking, where they want to innovate that and they want to make it like, you know, triple clicking now. But in order to triple click, don't you have to double click first? So are you violating the patent on double clicking in order to triple click?
You know, first of all, there's not really a patent on double clicking.
I know that. I'm just making bad examples. But
right. Yeah. Well, what's interesting, though, I mean, if you have something that simplistic
work with me,
where you say, technically you would have to. And see, that's what's interesting. When you have a patent, you do not have the right to practice what you claim. Okay? And that's something people get hung up on. I have a patent, I must be able to do X. Because patents are like I was talking about how you think of it as a bunch of concentric circles. That circle in the middle, at the very center, it might be violating on 10, 15 valid patents. So, especially if you're in startup in semiconductor industries, some software industries, you have to take a lot of licenses to be able to release products. And that's just the nature of the beast, but at the same time, you're entitled to innovate and patent your ideas as well. But and really, it's that's true of just about every industry. You're going to have to be taking licensing fees. Is that right? Is that wrong? I don't know. But we definitely have, we have patents on everything. And why should software be any different?
Well, I guess probably one of the reasons that we look at this and say, and again, when we go back and look at this claim, it makes it almost impossible to write a novel implementation that would work with this technology, that would work with the VFAT file system, not violate the claim, but yet be able to use technology that implements it. Because, you pull VFAT out, and now you've broken support for, a lot of flash devices, a lot of cameras. And sure, you can reformat that into a different file system, but is the device going to support that? It's...
Right. That's a good question. That's something camera makers have to think about. Do they want to support closed standards or patented standards or non-patented standards? There's plenty of implementations they could use that are out there. The problem is they want to cater to the Windows audience, and, this is what they want to use.
Well,
unfortunately, it is a very well-drafted claim. There's no... based on I've done a fairly cursory reading of it, but if you're implementing long file names under FAT, you're going to be reading on this claim.
It
does present a problem for any kind of free solution, but that's the nature of the beast.
Because this kind of reminds me of the whole video codec problem, which I'm sure is patented also. Like Windows Media files are patented, and Apple's QuickTime is probably patented that technology. And and it's similar to that because you could say, well, why won't a company implement an open standard? Well, first off, out of the box, Windows doesn't support most of the open standards. It doesn't support Aug. It doesn't support Theora.
It doesn't support any open standards.
Right, but remember, they're not a monopolist. No, not at all.
Right.
And, and Apple's the same thing. It supports, it supports QuickTime, but it doesn't support. So if a company wants to implement an open technology, they either have to include that open technology in some kind of driver disk, because out of the box, it's not going to work with Microsoft products. Because they don't have that, and it almost makes it's an unfair advantage to some respect. So, a company's going to look and say...
It really is. It's the whole issue you had with lock-in with the browser in Microsoft, which, that case, it's really surprising the way it turned out. Microsoft was losing until the original trial judge started spouting off to some magazine. He got pulled off. He would have busted Microsoft up. They would have faced huge sanctions. It would be a
like they are in Europe now, right?
But he was mouthing. Yeah. It might have even been worse than what the EC did to him. The EC made him tear out the browser. It made him share some source code. But I think it could have even been worse in America had the original trial judge not been pulled off the case.
Hey, Brad, people in the IRC want to know, do you own any patents yourself?
No.
Have you worked on any patents that we might know about, that you can actually tell us about?
Probably none of you were. As you'll notice, this is patent, what we're looking at is patent 5,758. I've had a couple issued. Some in the 6 million series. I think I've even had one in the 7 million series that just started this year. But in general, I do a lot of stuff that deals with oil field tools, some database stuff, stuff I really enjoy, but probably nothing that's anywhere near this infamous.
So what you're saying then is, you're when we're looking at software patents, you're probably looking at a lot of stuff that 99% of the world's never going to use, or you're looking at specific implementations where you just said oil. Oil industry. So you're looking at some company develop some in-house product, and then they patent it, and then they can go on and sell it, and that's something that 99% of the world's not going to use. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's true. I guess the patents I work on fall into two big camps. A lot of the software patents I work on deal with very, very specific ways to optimize, you know, database searching, stuff like that. And that's just my favorites to work on because you get to deal with some higher-level math and some really smart inventors and stuff like that. But to tell you the truth, you would never be able to tell if the competitor is infringing on the patent without having access to their source code, and you're never going to get it. Companies like to build up a portfolio like that, and especially the oil companies. It's basically a mutually assured destruction scenario in that if one of their competitors sues them on a patent, they have 10 patents and they can turn around and sue the competitor on. IBM is the master of that. They've been number one in issued patents probably for the past 15, 20 years. They get tons and tons and tons. And they make a lot of money off licensing revenue. Microsoft came to the patent game really, really late. And as a result, they've been paying out a ton of licensing revenue every year. They're just now starting to get into sending in a whole bunch of patent applications. They'd actually like to make some money on patents instead of just paying out royalties every year.
I got a question for you, Brad. If a company decides to sue somebody for patent infringement, on average, how long will that case take to go through the system, including the any appeals that might happen after the fact?
Quickest, I would say 2 years. Longest, 15. Patent cases take an extremely long time to go through.
What's the average?
It's my phone.
I actually don't know a statistic on the average. I would probably say, I'm going to take a wild guess, 4 years. From where you filed your suit to where you collect money.
Here's the question of the hour, though, right? We're all talking about these, in specific, we're making real references to Microsoft-held patents and what would happen if they started pulling some of this stuff out on the general Linux population or the general world population, really. But you made reference to this before. You know, what is it going to do for them to start enforcing this patent when there's no money to be made and all of that stuff. So are we really looking
right.
at,
I mean,
even with all these patents that were filed for things that I think personally are ridiculous and probably other people do too, what's the marketability for really having this stuff? I mean, you know, and why are we allowing people to make hundreds and millions of patents on things that they're not willing or unable to enforce because of a global community or whatever else? What's the point? Is it just a way for them to, you know, have that litigious back end going on in case somebody else does something similar? They can go back and sue them, or, you know, what is it?
In a lot of situations, that is what's happening. Say you have patents are held by big companies that spend a lot on R&D, so they get a lot of patents out of it. So they're basically, you know, they're in a products race on one level with their competitors. And then on another level, looking, you know, 2 to 10 years out, they're patenting the technology that they're going to be using. And everybody's doing that. On another level, you have a lot of really small inventors who maybe they do, they actually practice what they're patenting, maybe they don't. That's one of the big issues right now in patent law, and those are called, non-practicing patentees, better known as trolls. So, yeah, I mean, the classic scenario, you think about it, you know, it's like IBM and Intel are going to square off, and they're going to throw thousands of patents at each other.
Right.
They have cross-licensing deals, okay, so that's just never going to happen. That's the mutually assured destruction scenario. The thing that's really scary to big companies like Microsoft is where you have, you know, some guy who has a patent on something that they're doing, He doesn't make any software. He can go out there and just sue them for all it's worth. That's the thing you're seeing with Merck Exchange and eBay. Merck Exchange is generally referred to as a troll because there's nothing that eBay can turn around and sue them for because they're not doing anything to violate any patents.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two big scenarios of patent infringement suits you'll see. I don't think the end consumer really has a worry about patent infringement because it is so expensive to go through with a patent infringement lawsuit. Copyright lawsuits, like that's the RIA bring, those are fairly easy procedures to go through, not that expensive. I doubt you're ever going to see Microsoft suing every Linux user, though, for having FAT support built into their kernel.
But they don't have to sue every Linux user. They just have to sue one. And then that's going to send a ripple throughout the industry saying, well, you know, we can't use this technology
but
for fear.
But they can't really because it's a U.S. patent and Linux is a global community.
Right, but they
can't. Right, I mean, Microsoft definitely didn't care about damages from any one user.
If Microsoft ever wanted to sue for the FAT patent thing, that what they would do is they'd go after the makers of the flash cards and the memory cards and the cameras and shit like that.
But that would be a mistake because that's they're further supporting those devices. But if they went after somebody like IBM or Novell or somebody like a company that implemented a Linux solution in their business, and they said, okay, we're going to sue you because you're implementing Linux and violating the FAT patent, as an example, they just have, like I said, they only have to sue one entity, and it's going to send a message to the industry that you're violating, use of Linux violates a patent. Even though if it might not be the case, but it's going to be a perception issue.
But
I don't know. No, I think you'd have a big resistance to it. If Microsoft did anything, it would want, instead of looking for damages, and I'm sure all the flash card makers and digital camera makers already take licenses under this patent, so they don't have a problem with it. If they wanted to shut down free implementations of it, what they would want to do is try to get an injunction against people distributing Linux. And that's just impossible to do,
right?
Especially with a U.S. patent, because you have all this development going on overseas. Your servers can be anywhere. You can't stop it. So, I mean, it's almost an academic question. I really don't even see a ripple effect. I mean, if they sue IBM on this, IBM will take a license for their customers. They take plenty of licenses anyway.
Now, here's a question: being that, all right. Say I'm running Linux and my current Linux implementation has the ability to violate that patent. Am I violating the patent if I don't use that ability?
No. You neither.
If I never use a FAT device on my computer, it wouldn't make any
difference. Depends on how you read the claim. It depends on what type of claim they have in here. Let's see. In method claims, you have to actually practice the method. It is possible to patent source or binary code itself, but there's not one of those claims in here. So,
okay.
It is possible to violate a patent by just having a capability, but basically the act that you're doing in that case is that you're storing code on your computer.
But it would have to specifically say, that in order for me to violate the patent, I would have to be, using something or just storing it or something like that.
In some cases, simply having code on your computer will violate the patent. In this case, this bad patent, that's not the case. All active steps, you have to create, store, da-da-da-da-da.
Right. So it would be impossible then for me to violate that patent if I did not have a device with FAT on it.
Because I know you're not going to build FAT support into your kernel.
Well, even if it's built into the kernel, if I never use it, what difference does it make, right?
You wouldn't violate this one.
Good. See, there we go. Ha! We found a loophole.
Yeah, but if you plugged in a flash device and it had the VFAT format and you mounted it, you'd violate the patent.
Okay, here's another question for you. Mm-hmm. Say at one point in my life I had purchased a copy of Windows. Okay, or DOS for that matter. DOS 622 had long file name support. So at one point in my life I had purchased a copy of Windows which had, of course, long file name support. Now, I do own a copy of Windows. I purchased one legally at one point in my life. If I use a FAT device on my Linux system, and am I violating the copyright because I have purchased rights to do that? May not be on the same software that I'm running now, but I did purchase software to do that from them.
All right. The answer is no. You do not have rights to do it under Linux. In general, you have to read the horrible in-user license agreement that comes with the software to see if it gives you a general license to practice on their patents. But mm-hmm. I can tell you right now that it doesn't.
Nifty.
So, right. So you would have to be accessing the FAT file system under Windows to not be violating the patent there.
Brad, I got a question for you. In your opinion, how solid is the GPL? You know, will it hold up in court cases?
Oh, the GPL's great. Yeah, I mean, and no one's ever challenged it in the U.S. That shows you how solid it is.
How about two? Have you looked at the second one, GPL 2 they're coming out with?
Three.
GPL 3, okay.
Three.
Apparently.
No, I haven't looked at 3 yet. I understand it has some good anti-DRM provisions in it and stuff like that. I've done some advice on open source licensing. I love the MPL. It's probably the best drafted license out there right now. The GPL is great, though. You know, it's very enforceable.
So you say, I mean, generally speaking, a company or Microsoft is not going to sue a Linux vendor or a company using Linux. It would be a bad idea if they did for using Linux for violating any patents. Yet you have Steve Ballmer this past week in an interview saying, well, we're pretty sure Linux is violating some of our patents, and you'll be the first to hear about it when we decide to act on it. I mean, here we have one of the heads of the company basically saying it's coming. It's not a matter of if, it's when.
You know, I read that, but this will be the first patent suit Microsoft's going to file. You know, Microsoft's been getting sued left and right. I have no idea who they're going to go after or which patents they're going to sue on. And I really don't, other than some of the big system providers like IBM and stuff like that, I don't know who they're going to be going after.
So, but even if they go after anybody, it's gonna send a message to the community, to users all over the world, and say, wait a minute, you risk getting sued, and then they're gonna play that FUD machine up. They're gonna say, well, if you're gonna implement this technology, there's a possibility you're gonna get sued, or we're coming after you.
You know, I really think that should backfire. Okay, I'm not saying go out and violate all of Microsoft's patents that you know about. Da, 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 da. But, I mean, Microsoft is stronger because people have implemented FAT on Linux. I mean, you can look at it two ways. Is Linux stronger for having FAT? No. We have some damn good file systems on Linux. FAT is the last thing we need. You know, we're just sitting there and propping up the last remnant of DOS 7 by implementing this crappy file system under the Linux kernel. So it behooves Microsoft from a business point of view to have people violating the patent. Now, to the extent that they can get some licensing fees out of IBM and some other big vendors and stuff like that, that's something they might try to do. But I doubt they're looking to get IBM out of the Linux business or anything like that. And you know, I really don't see any big ripples going through the community. You certainly didn't have any effect at Linux at all from the SCO suit. The Microsoft suit might maybe slightly more legitimate. But
there was a little bit. There was some, you know, there was some FUD rolling around about, you know, maybe you shouldn't use Linux because you might end up getting sued. I didn't see it happen a whole lot, but there was some, you know. I think if Microsoft pulled something like that,
yeah,
it would be a bigger deal.
There probably was some talk for about 2 weeks where IT managers might have been kind of nervous. But, you know, as soon as IBM started offering indemnification to everyone, they figured out that, you know, this was a joke,
right,
and they didn't need to take it seriously.
But, okay, but now, you know, you got the other side to this here and saying, like, I work in a school district, and I say, well, I'd love to implement Linux technology, but if the technology violates patents, morally, ethically, can I do that? You know, here we are saying, well, you know, it's bad to illegally use Microsoft software to make use of illegal copies, to not pay for the license. But, you know, and the same token, can I say, yeah, let's use some Linux machines, but they have the VFAT into the kernel. And if somebody plugs in a flash device, we're violating the patents. So ethically, you can't use it.
Not really, because they're not enforcing it, right?
Legally, you can't use it. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm the last person you should be asking about ethics.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about it.
Technically, legally, you're violating the patents there. You know, and your school district certainly doesn't have, you know, the time or money to go out and get a license from Microsoft on this. The saving grace is that other than this patent that I just made you read, you don't know about any patents that Microsoft has, or you haven't read through the claims and know that you're infringing on it. You know, hopefully assuming Microsoft does start suing on their patents, you may see some of the bigger distribution providers like Red Hat, SUSE, Novell take a package of licenses from Microsoft. If Microsoft's willing to deal with them, that might be a pretty good showdown. Come to think of it, I hadn't thought of that. Would Microsoft be willing to settle with, say, Red Hat? Or would they just want to try to shut them out of using FAT? I don't know. It's something pretty interesting to think about.
Yeah, but would that really do any good since Linux is a global community and you know, like another Red Hat-ish project could just spring up in, like, the Netherlands or something like that where they could tell Microsoft to go hump themselves or something, you know?
Right. Or you know, you could... Or Red Hat would take it out and make it pretty easy to get the RPMs from to some offshore site.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, we talk about it being a global community. But we live here in the United States, and we're working in the United States, us. And where we work is a United States company. So, you know, if it ever came up to Linux starts getting a market share and starts rolling along really well, and Microsoft decides to start enforcing their patents and suing places that are using Linux, and, you know, smaller companies like your company or where I work aren't going to have the money to fight a patent case like that.
Yeah, but are they going to sue a small company because they're not going to get any money out of it? And even if they did, I'm sure that the judge would realize that that not every company in the world has the wherewithal to do research on every damn thing that they do for prior patents.
But they don't have to
sue
for
money.
Can't
you just change what you were doing real fast?
It's not about. It's not going to be about the money. It's going to be about scaring other people from using that technology so that they use Microsoft's technology instead.
But Microsoft is not going to sue and scare its own customers.
I beg to differ
on
that.
Don't piss your own customers off. If you're suing them and like the RIAA, you know what I mean? They're suing these people for download music, and the people are like, I'm never, ever buying another CD, you know, because I don't want them penny-pinching bastards to get a cent. So I can see that happening, you know what I mean?
If they sued me, I
assure you I would never use any of their products ever again. And I'd make damn sure I didn't, but maybe I'm one of the few.
So you needed another excuse?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, not only there, yeah, I mean, and still, you know, people, normally people don't use Linux because they're, you know, exceedingly wealthy either. You know what I mean? My first foray into open source software was because, you know, I'm a cheap bastard. And I like Unix, which is even better, you know what I mean? Because at the time, you could buy Microsoft for $100. You could get, like, a SCO Unix license for, like, $500. Hey, Linux, that sounded great to me, you know?
But, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah, and you get real multitasking in Linux. That was a big draw for me. I had multiple consoles. You know.
Multi-threading, something that Windows still can't do, right?
So yeah. If we take the long view of this thing here, it's basically what it comes down to with regards to patents is, you know, generally speaking, patents are not evil, which is what you might say. They're good for protecting a person's investment and time, but the way that software patents are being implemented in the industry is a few key companies are using patents along with other advantages like a monopolistic corporation, which is where all the problems are coming from.
I can definitely agree with that. Monopoly behavior, when combined with patents, is a really dangerous thing, and something we have to look out for. But you know, that's up to the Department of Justice to decide what to do about.
That's it.
So if we abolish patents,
six more
we'd be
lawyers
out of a job,
on them, huh?
Eh?
I said, sick more lawyers on them, huh? That's it. That's the answer to everything.
Exactly.
Wow. You gave us a lot to think about.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so my big message to you, though, is the next time you see a Microsoft patent cited up on Slashdot, actually read the claims and not just the abstract, because you have to do the claims to infringe on it. That just pisses patent lawyers off to no end, that people will be like, oh, Microsoft just patented triple-clicking or whatever.
Right. Not only that, but you know, the patent holder has to give a shit, huh?
About what?
About you infringing on their patent.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
We're going to have to work on this whole thing about walking down the sidewalk in front of your house later, though. I'm going to patent that. I'll tell you what, I'll cut you in. We'll make some money. Everybody does it.
We'll be sad.
Yep.
So, what distribution of Linux are you using over there?
Gentoo!
Oh,
the GCC screensaver.
Exactly.
But that doesn't surprise me, since you're so into
reading. Yeah, and I hear you guys going off on Gentoo users all the time. But and I don't even use Gentoo to try to get, you know, the minimal speed increase out of building from source. The thing I love is being able to set up all your use flags successfully. What was the last time you were able to set up a mail server the way you wanted it without having to build from source? I've never been able to do it. You know, I love having to be able to set up, you know, like virtual domains, set it up to use like Postgres in the background, you know, with Cirrus IMAP. Da, da, da. You always have five or six components, and you're never able to find the right binary package that's going to link them all together. With Gentoo, that's all taken care of. And see, I never found it that hard to build, you know, my mail server or whatever the first time. But then you have to, you know, upgrade one of those components, and you have to remember all the flags you used before. You know, and it's pure living hell. Gentoo makes my life much easier, stable as hell, and, you know, it does give me a slight performance increase. We have a little in-house server that we use to do some intranet stuff just for the group. And had it not been for the hurricane where they turned off our power here, it would have had, like, about 3 years uptime. So at least it gave me an excuse to upgrade the kernel on it finally, because I wasn't about to take it down. But I love Gentoo. It's as good as it gets.
You know what? Another quick question from the forum was asked, if a company like SUSE or Red Hat made available from a server in Europe, the multimedia codecs for a playback of patented technology that Microsoft or Apple might have, would that make the company liable if people downloaded and used those codecs, or would the person be liable for violating a patent that actually downloaded and used them?
That's a good question. The act of infringement there is going to be importing. Definitely the person who downloads them is going to be liable for patent infringement. There may be an argument that simply by putting up a... No, but you set up an FTP server, and you could care less who's downloading from it. So, yeah, I'm not giving out legal advice here. I'm just kind of speculating. I don't think that the person who ran the FTP server would be liable in that case. Definitely the person who downloaded it would be liable if they went on and used the codecs.
Okay. Well, wait. So if you run... If you're in a country that doesn't uphold software, copyrights, patents, and all that, and you made for available for download that software, I guess they couldn't come after that person, could they? Who made available that for download those files because the server is in a country where it's not illegal to do that.
Under copyright, there's actually a slightly different answer there, I think.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty interesting. Because in general, there's no... I got to think about the outcome of the Grokster. I guess in... Because Grokster wasn't actually... I guess it was a U.S. corporation, wasn't it? I'm really not sure on that. That's a good question. In general, you probably want... I mean... First of all, they got to be able to get at you to sue you, and if you're in a foreign country, it's tough for them to get you. So,
or if you downloaded from a foreign country, it's tough for them to find out who downloaded it, right?
Yeah, exactly. If they're not going to be able to subpoena the server logs.
Oh, okay. Now, have the kind of law that you practice, you don't actually end up in court defending anything, do you?
No, not really. I mean, I get a lot of patents. I do work on some patent litigation, but I'm pretty low level, and the odds of me ever appearing in court unless I, you know, get arrested for drunk and disorderly are pretty low. But I do some litigation, though.
Are you VI or Emacs?
VI.
Yes!
What's your window manager / desktop environment of choice?
Fluxbox.
Oh, there you go.
There we go. Nice. He's a smart guy.
Gen 2 VI Fluxbox. Man.
Smart guy. You know, got some good stuff going for you. Everything
but
except
unfortunately,
for Gen 2
at work, we
thing.
Have to run. See, this is one of my big beats with Linux. Maybe you guys can help me out on this. One of the big reasons we have to run Windows up at work is because... we use a document management system. And I just don't know of any Linux alternatives. I don't know if you guys have heard of any.
What kind of document management system?
So, basically, there's a huge database of all the documents that are on our system. They're classified by client, by matter, by type, by author. I mean, because we produce, you know, probably millions of documents every year within the firm. So it's really too large to deal with on file share. So basically, it's a database system just for all the Word and Excel sheets and stuff like that. And yes, we have to use Word because that's our appliance.
Does this document system like automatically collect metadata from your documents?
Yeah, when you create a new document, you have to enter the codes that correspond to what client it's for, what matter for that client it's for, your author, and all the stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
It's really not done automatically.
Well, why couldn't you use any database then? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I guess the question would be,
are you
using an application at work that's been customized for your environment, or is it like a company had this document management program and you implemented it and configured it for your environment?
It's called OpenDocs. I mean, this is a pretty well, it's just about every law firm I know uses this.
We've never heard of it because we're not lawyers or working law firms.
It's Open Docs, but obviously it's not an open source application.
No, no, it's definitely not open. Let me see. Actually, and then for some reason the little viewer we have here is called Hummingbird DM. But, I guess a lot of non-lawyers have never heard of it. But, you know, and I thought about it, like, if you try to implement this in a general database and have the Word docs be blobs, I really don't know anything that can handle it. It would scale that well. So it's slightly outside the reach of anything I could come up with. Actually, it's pretty far outside the reach of anything I could come up with. But it's definitely something where I would love to see an open source implementation.
What we can do is, hopefully people will email us with some choices. I'm pretty sure there's stuff out there.
Oh, I'm sure someone has seen something. We'll just, put a general call out. Somebody knows what kind of thing he's looking for, send us an email, and, we'll refer the email back to you.
Now, somebody is saying MagSafe. Who's saying MagSafe? MagScrew. But I don't know what MagSafe is.
I don't know what this application does. We'd have to take a look at it and see what's available.
On one thing, are you looking at the IRC?
I mean, the whole thing to me, I work with databases all day long, so to me it sounds like you just need someone to take a 10-second code trip and put some search criteria into a database and whip up some stupid little interface for you to look for stuff. That's what it sounds like to me. But I'm sure that there's something a bit more polished for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's just something I was looking into a little while ago at work was document management.
Cody says document www.documentum.com.
I was just over there. I'm not sure exactly if that's open.
Documentum. I got to take a look at that. Yeah. Sounds fun. So any of you guys have patents?
Yeah, we just filed 3 or 4 the other day.
I'm thinking about 4 or 5 more now,
Dan's patenting farts.
I'm patenting a fart delivery system.
A methane, or no, yeah, methane delivery apparatus.
There's the Taco Bell fart and the broccoli
White Castle
fart and the White Castle fart.
A giant funnel over his ass.
Able to power a small city for 1 week at a time.
That's not nice.
All right, a big city.
It's not nice. Bum, bum, bum. There was another question on the IRC.
But no, hopefully someone will send us some stuff that... some stuff that might help you out there. That would be cool.
Another question that was on the IRC was regarding the way that the European Parliament Commission is viewing laws differently than the U.S. and suing Microsoft. And I guess the question is, do they view patents and the software patents that people like Microsoft are trying to get introduced differently?
Europe is a little more restrictive on software patents. They make you have some kind of physical result. Like, you can still patent having a computer do something, but typically in Europe, they want to see some kind of physical end result of using the software. So you can get software patents, but they have to have some kind of physical implementation at the end. I think there was a big debate, I guess about 9 months ago, over broadening software patents in Europe, and it was kind of shot down. So,
all right.
Let's see. What are some of the other questions in here?
That's what we need to do. Damn it! No software patents.
Say no to software patents.
No software patents. Make them patent something real.
Patents, but then probably be out of a job.
No way, man. He's a lawyer.
Seriously, that's like a something patent to do.
Lawyer.
He's a lawyer. Lawyers will always have Lawyers will always have a job in America.
There you go. Try out www.xinco.org, zinco.org, for an open source document management system.
Whoa, there you go. See, now that is some serious delivery that you get right on the tech show.
But would it
hook you right
nice.
Now?
Something to check out.
Let's see.
Wonder if they have a Debian package for it.
Debian?
Now we're going to get hate mail. It's not Debian, damn it. Don't know why you guys always say that shit.
Brad, I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us, because I don't want to...
My pleasure.
You could stay on, you know, as long as you want. I just wanted to... We got like 8 minutes, and...
Yeah, we had a lot of fun
talking
to you.
We thank
you
before we got
to
close things down.
Sure.
I do have something I want to say that's not on this topic, and Brad, you're more than welcome to weigh your opinion in on this.
Sure.
There's been a lot of discussion the past couple of months in the open source community, Linux community in particular, and I think in all communities in general. One of the opinions that I keep hearing time and time again with regards to Linux on a desktop is usability and integration, which goes hand in hand with usability, and people saying, well, you know, usability studies have shown that we still have a little work to go. And probably the single application that I hear the most complaints about is the GIMP. And that the GIMP's interface is horrendous. That it's terrible. It should be more like Photoshop. And so many people are complaining about the GIMP, and the developers don't really seem to be too concerned about whether, you know, the GIMP caters to those people that use Photoshop. Now, my side, I've been thinking about this a lot, and part of me has been saying, you know, I didn't come from Photoshop to the GIMP. So my first experience with a image manipulation program of that style has been the GIMP, and I've been accustomed to the GIMP, and I'm used to the interface. Now, when I go to Photoshop, I have the reverse. I look at Photoshop, and it's difficult for me to use because I'm so accustomed to the GIMP.
Right.
And the question is, you know, should the GIMP developers, you know, look at this and say, well, you know, yeah, you're right, we need to make it look more like Photoshop? Or should they say, well, look, this is the way that we put it together. This is the way it's always been. The usability is quite the opposite for we GIMP users when we go to Photoshop. But then the other side of that, I say, is after doing usability studies and tests and everything, if these studies have produced significant results to say the way that Photoshop is designed is the best interface for that type of application, and if the GIMP wants to make any inroads into that environment, they should develop their user interface to be more usable, as per Photoshop did.
Yes. That's what I think.
Yes to it all.
Pretty much. Now, like you said, you did not come from a Photoshop background to GIMP. You came from GIMP, went from GIMP to a Photoshop. I came from Print Shop to GIMP, you know, and the two are like way different. However, I also believe that the coders of GIMP have have consulted Satan for the design of the interface. I really and honestly believe that, because some of that shit makes no sense at all. And I'm an intelligent person, you know, much to the disagreement of some people, but, and there are some things on there I can't figure out, and a lot of things that I can't find. You know what I mean? I think they need to have some non-image, you know, or some image stupid person go into the software and figure out what they want to do and figure out how to make those options make more sense and be more accessible. It's just a little bit of a, you know, they just need a little bit of work there. I think that the program itself is fantastic, and it does all kinds of, does shit that I've never even, you know, thought of doing yet. But I think the interface needs a little help. My opinion. Does that mean it has to look like Photoshop? Absolutely not. Because I do not think that any Windows program or any other third-party program, Photoshop or whatever the hell, has the whole grasp of usability or interface usability or interface standards. I think, you know, we can do our own and make it better. Make it just as good or better. But it doesn't have to be, you know, just like when everybody says, when are you going to fix the Linux stuff so that the Linux desktop is good like Windows? And that's a bullshit thing. What we need to do is, if there are people having problems with the Linux desktop, we need to make the Linux desktop better. But that does not necessarily mean that we need to make it like anything else in order to do so. We can make it better on our own. You know what I mean?
We have the technology.
We have the technology, damn it, that's right. Weren't we like doing the $6 million man in the car on the way over here?
We were doing that on the way over, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really great that a bunch of the open source projects are finally doing some real usability studies. I don't think anybody's done real usability studies since, you know, IBM did all of its time and motion, you know, studies back in probably the 70s. Supposedly Windows did, but I don't see how they learned anything from that with the user interface that they produce. So I know Novell has been doing a whole bunch, and, you know, I think they should really just go with whatever is the best empirically for people to use. But then I think it also raises another question, because there's a best interface for a user who's going to be using things day to day, and then a best interface to have a less steep learning curve. And
yeah, but doesn't it mean that Windows or Photoshop necessarily has a corner on the market? No.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we can develop our own, you know, very simple and easy interface. We don't have to copy somebody else's. So I have this big disagreement with people who say, we need to make GIMP like Photoshop, and we need to make, we need to make the Linux desktop work like Windows. No, we don't. We need to make the Linux desktop work like a really good desktop.
Right. Yeah. I don't really even think we should be focusing on making things that easy. I mean, the whole reason I like Linux is not because, you know, it's the easiest to get into or whatever. It's that once you learn how to use it, it's the most powerful and it's the fastest to use.
Right.
That's why I use something like Flux.
Sure. There are some advantages to having a cerebral operating system, you know, as opposed to being, you know, some retarded kind of, you know, Mac OS sort of thing.
Well, here
I heard the snicker back there.
But then again, in the industry, or what the GIMP is designed to do, over in the on the flip side, the leading application is Photoshop, and you know, when people say, you know, usability and the interface should be a whole lot better, they don't really have any other example to look at other than Photoshop. Now, because what else is there? There's not that much.
I don't know, but that doesn't mean that we can't make something that's just as easy to use.
Right. We got to close off with BinRev.
We're
thank
done
you.
With BinRev.
Bye,
good
bye,
night,
BinRev. I feel like a heel. All right. Well, we can keep going on anyhow. But this brings up another question with regards to usability and studies. Now, this is probably going to get a lot of hate mail for this one.
Oh,
but
boy.
We are back to the KDE to GNOME debate here.
Uh-huh.
And what we're seeing is a lot of studies are coming out where people or companies are going towards the GNOME desktop, are saying that the GNOME desktop is more usable with regards to usability studies than KDE. And that one of the complaints is, you know, GNOME has configurability to a point where it's enough for a new user but not overkill, which is the opposite of KDE. And it's odd because then you'd say, well, KDE seems to cater to the Windows user going into Linux a little more because it looks more like Windows than GNOME does. But the studies seem to be showing quite the opposite. Now, we got a dilemma here because you go out and you buy a book on Linux, a new user Linux book, and a lot of them are KDE-centric.
Right.
Should we start seeing GNOME-centric books? Because my dad, for instance, I gave my dad the book Kiss the Blue Screen of Death Goodbye. I put him on a Ubuntu machine, but default it goes to GNOME. So he looks at this book and he says, all this stuff in this book looks nothing like the desktop I have over here.
Right.
So I said, well, no, just switch to KDE.
Right.
But now you got Ubuntu, you got SUSE, Red Hat, all these distributions are defaulting to GNOME as opposed to KDE, where are the GNOME books? And should
these... I think there should be some.
Should these new user books, should Marcel and all these other people say, well, wait a minute, let's start looking at what the distribution, what the companies are putting out, what somebody's going to go out and buy off the shelf.
Sure.
It's going to be GNOME. That's what the places are saying. We need to put out more GNOME information.
Sure. Well, you know, I think a lot of the book people are missing their market. You know what I mean? Because... That not only is there KDE and GNOME, you know what I mean? Everybody has to push those two. There are really, really, really good alternatives to those two. And there's no reason why, you know, some of that information couldn't be mentioned in, you know, in some of these books. I mean, they're making books for really stupid people, I think. What if I buy a computer and I don't know anything about it, but I don't like KDE or GNOME? Perhaps I'm putting Linux on my machine because I don't want to have it look and run like Windows anymore. You know, perhaps. So maybe they're missing a little bit of their market by not catering at least a little bit to that kind of individual as well.
Well, I think that individual...
Who the hell am I? I'm nobody. I'm just a user.
Yeah, you are nobody. But I think that individual is a smaller subset of that larger group that's going to want to go try to transition from Linux or Windows to Linux. Right off the bat, you know, when we've seen it time and time again, when they go and they install Linux, they're looking at, you know, either KDE or GNOME,
right.
And that's what they start using.
Right.
And you suggest, you know, XFCE. If you put a person who's always used Windows all their life in front of Window Maker and say, go for it, they're going to be like, what the F? And they go out and they buy a book.
You know? I don't think it's that difficult.
No, it's not that difficult, but it's a shock. But you put them in front of KDE or GNOME, it's a little more familiar to them. KDE more. And most of the distributions have kind of focused on defaulting to those.
But that's just it. You know, do we really have to push for making everything look and work like Windows, or can't we come up with our own shit and make it better? You know what I mean? Instead of, why, you know, we'll run Linux because it's just like Windows. No, screw that. I don't want to run anything like Windows. Windows doesn't freaking work. That's why I'm not running Windows. That's why I'm running something else. You know, I want it to look and feel like something different. And, you know, if you're that freaking stupid that you can't learn anything, maybe you should just stick with, you know, your problematic Windows installs. But you really should bear, each user should bear some small, even if it's an infinitesimal portion of culpability to learn what the hell they're using. You know, it's that whole thing that I keep referencing with driving a car. You know what I mean? Even though every adult is able to purchase a car in this country, you still have to have a license to drive. They want you to know how to do it. They want you to know where the hell the gas pedal is and what it does and stuff like that. And they're not doing that with computer use, which, you know, can be just as dangerous, really.
Yeah, but on the flip side, the point of a computer is you should be able to sit down, say, I want to type out a Word document or word processing, or I want to surf the web, or I want to do X, Y, and Z, burn a CD,
right.
And it should work right out of the box. You shouldn't have to learn the underworkings of the computer to be able to do that.
You don't think so? Because you have to do that with Windows.
Windows makes you do that. I'm not saying Windows. I'm saying usability. You go to a car. You drive a car. You don't know how to. You don't have to know how the engine works to drive the car.
How to open the door. You have to know how to use the gas pedal.
Right.
You have to know
what
the brake is. If it's standard, you have to know how to do a standard, you know, a manual transmission.
But all you need to should be able to do is just fire up the application and begin going.
It still requires some knowledge. You cannot take somebody that lived on an island in the middle of nowhere, has never seen a car when they're an adult, and give them a car and expect them to be able to drive down the road. It's the same thing with computer users.
Yeah, but
just because they may have seen a computer at one time does not mean that they're qualified to use one. You know what I mean?
But my mom bought me a computer for Christmas.
Exactly, finally, right. Yeah, somebody bought me that car, but, you know, who cares if I, you know, I use it.
That caffeine's finally kicking in there, huh, Link?
The idea of the technology is to make it as simple as possible for somebody to use without having to know the inner workings.
Certainly it is.
They should
yes.
be able to point and click and fire up that application.
Not necessarily. That's where you're getting yourself into trouble, because you're defining in your mind and pushing that definition on everybody else of what an easy, simple interface is. And what I'm saying is that maybe we need to consult with some people who don't know any of this to find out what a simple mechanism would be for them to use.
Yeah,
computer.
But that's what usability studies are for.
Yeah, but I don't think they're approaching it the same way that I'm talking about. I think they're approaching their usability studies as from a Windows point of view. How can we make Linux work like Windows? And I don't want it to do that. I want it from a non-user point of view. If you want to make it an easy desktop, you need to find somebody who hasn't used either one of them and find out what would make it easy for them instead of making something, you know, and that makes it intuitive on a personal level, not intuitive to someone who's used Windows. That's my point, I guess.
Well, I think I agree with you, and I think that would be a fair study. Mm-hmm. You don't just take Windows users or Apple users, and you take a mixture of all of them.
Sure.
To find out.
No, well, I'm saying you don't take any of them. You know what I mean?
It's like
people
who say...
Well, no, you'd have to take To do a fair study, you'd have to include every subset of your population.
It's like people who say that OS X is supposedly that much better and easier to learn for somebody. I disagree. If you know, it's not any more easy to learn Linux or learning Windows. It's the same shit.
Yeah. I mean, that's evidenced by... I mean, you had your kids grow up learning Linux, right? They didn't have any problems with it.
No, but you
know, they switched back and forth from one to the other without any problem. I've seen that too. I've seen people at work who are non-computer users. I put them in front of a Linux box; they use it just as easily as they would a Windows box. The only people that seem to have problems are the people who have been ingrained for the last 20 years that, you know, this is how it's supposed to work the Microsoft way, and that's how we make it easy. And I see a lot of that. A lot of people talking that way in the Linux community. This is how we make it easy. We make it look like Microsoft. Or this is how we make it look pretty. We make it look like Apple OS X. And that's bullshit. Because not only is that not always the easiest way, it's also not always the prettiest way either. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think the problem that I can understand where that mindset comes from. Because if I put my daughters down there, who used the KDE interface,
right?
They've grown up with that. Mm-hmm. When I bring them up on XFCE, they're not sure how to launch their applications or where they are, you know. But you say, well, just right click and there's the menu, and then they can find it.
Right.
I put them down there on OS X. If the application isn't in the dock, they don't know where to find it. But if I say, open this up and then go to applications, and you should see a list of your applications. Oh, there's the icon that matches it. Then they'll be able to find it.
Okay, but here we are right back again at the user portion of culpability.
Right.
That they have to at some point take culpability for their own actions and learn a little bit about the system.
But
and then all of a sudden the whole world is open. You know what I mean? When you learn just a little bit. Everything just opens up to you. Then now your kids are using multiple window managers, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
And being able to get around and do what they need to do as opposed to dumbing everything down.
But the thing is...
And only giving the one option.
But the thing is, you are in a corporation, you're running a business, and all your people are using or used to using Windows. And the majority of the world does use Windows, as a fact. And you say, well, now I want to switch over to Linux. Am I going to drop them into XFCE, FVWM?
Yes, and I'll
tell
you why.
Or am I going to drop them into KDE because it looks more like Windows?
Yes, and
it would be stupid to drop them into FVWM.
No, yes, and I'll tell you why. Because if they're an employee of your company, number one, they're responsible to learn the material you give them. Number two is that I do not believe that the majority of the world uses Windows. And I want to tell you, and people are going to disagree with me, but I want to define that a little bit real quick. Most people use a web browser, and most people use an email program, but they do not use Windows. That's all they do. And they don't give a shit what operating system it's on. You know what I mean? Not only that, But, you know, some of them even play games on them. But what is doing that? What is that on Windows? That's nothing more than you know, having a different kind of console. You know, a different kind of game console. It's the same shit.
Yeah, but
you
now
know,
we got
moved on to a different platform.
But FEWM or any of these other ones, Window Maker, for instance, if the icon that they're not familiar with isn't on the desktop, they're going to be lost. You know, what happens then when they want to save something or they want to pull something up that they saved? You know, we see this time and again on OS X.
They have to learn something about it?
We see this time and again on OS X. In Windows, it maps the drive, so they go down to their H drive. That's their home directory. Now you go over to OS X, it mounts the service. It mounts the share. So now you don't go to an H drive. You go to volumes, that, and you got to cruise your way through the whole directory structure to save in your home directory. And that confuses people. And you can sit there and show them.
I cruise through everything. I just click the icon.
But that's you. I'm talking about the implementation. You know, and now if we did Linux in there, it's another thing. When you pull up where you save your stuff, unless the home directory is mounted off a share, you logged in, you'd have to, if it mounted a share as in a generic location like Windows does,
right,
you'd have to browse to it, and it's a little different than clicking on an H.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that there isn't work to be done in the Linux. You know,
no, I'm not saying that.
I'm sure
there's
a lot of work that needs to be done and a lot of standardization. But what I'm saying is that we don't have to standardize on it the way that Windows does it. We can standardize on making something that's really easy and very simple to understand, and make that available as an option. And I know, and we gotta get going because.
Yeah, well, I see what you're
Alan's,
saying.
Alan's my ride, and he's like packing his packing it in, man.
The bus will be leaving soon.
I see what you're saying, but I also see what businesses are and other places are saying. Well, we want something that's
I see
familiar.
Your point too, but I just think it's a cop out. That's my position on it.
Well, people are lazy.
That's exactly right. People are lazy and people are dumb.
They don't want to learn something new.
Patent lawyers are especially lazy.
It's a sheeple.
Is he still there? Are you still there, Brad?
Yeah, just about head on out.
Yeah.
Well, I want to
see,
thank
now,
you
he's bored with our bullshit back and forth, too, right? You know it's really bad if we're arguing positions and the patent attorney is
all
like,
all I have to say, if it's not smart as he's
I'm just kind of amazed that, like, all cars have to come with printed instruction manuals, but you never expect an OS to.
Right, exactly.
What is that then?
There you go. That's exactly my point, and both of them are deadly tools, I think.
Oh, yeah.
You can get into a lot of trouble both ways. Anyway, that was my whole point on it.
Can I do some quick shout-outs real quick?
Do some shout-outs. We're going to pack it up. Listen, yep. Everybody, thank you for listening to episode 129. Catch us again next week, all week long, probably with little bits and bobs here and there, maybe, during the LWE.
Wait, is Brad, are you still there?
I think he dropped off.
No, he dropped off.
No, he did.
He just bonged out.
We'll try to get some pictures up of the show during on the Flickr,
proper,
too.
Yeah. Proper shout-outs. We got P.J. Santor from Bethlehem, P.A. Hallmark from Winfield, Missouri. Ooh. We got Joel Casey from Crossville, Tennessee. Nick, 125 from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dave Gardner from Los Angeles, California. We've got John from San Francisco, California.
P.J.
We've
Santor.
Got Chris
Birdsell
from Prospect, Tennessee.
I wonder.
Chris from Manchester, England. John Milton from Kansas City, Missouri. Gary Curtin from London, England, UK. Dave Favreau from Hanoi, Dong Bang, Song Hong, Vietnam. Bicep from Mount Joy, PA.
Now, where was that in Vietnam, man?
Dong Bang, Song Hong.
He sounds like he's showing a tin can down a Dong Bang with a rocket in it. Bing, bang, ding, ding.
Ontario, Canada. Joshua Solomon from Pittsburgh, PA.
Wait, Pat.
What?
I don't see any of the songs that you wanted me to play.
They're in my home directory.
Are they MP3s?
Some MP3s, some one OG, I think.
Because I have a...
Just play one. Pick one.
Yeah, but I have we did the Velvet Project before. Yeah. Hip Hop High.
How about you do Save a God?
Save a God? I don't have Save a God.
Atomic Opera?
No, I didn't have that
one.
It's
an OG.
That's why I don't have them, because I just did the MP3s. I have Chance, Hip Hop High, and 07-Frozen.
Do you see Cell Dweller?
No, I'm not over there yet. I was over. All right, keep doing your shout outs.
Okay. Cylinder Russ from London, England. Lord Dragonblood from Bloomington, Indiana. Odin Horthumdal from Stavanger, Rugland, Norway. Shane from Kelso, Washington. Dave QB from Sydney, Australia. Sumesh Baranwal from Philadelphia, PA. Dan Sarceno from Bristol, Connecticut. Saba Veres from Trondheim, Norway. Pasi Rautonen from Rovaniemi, Lapland, Finland. Mike from Houston, Texas. And Kyle McMurphy from Irving, Texas. Thank you, everybody.
All right, everybody. Good night.
Good night. Good night. See you in Boston, baby.
All right, so this is, you want to, who is this, Pat, that we're playing?
Atomic Opera, you got that one?
Yeah, Make a God.
Make a God. This is a really good band from Houston, Texas. Excellent.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Next week we'll have... we're not going to be live next week. I don't even know if we're going to have a show going on at this time.
Well, we probably have some... upload some audio stuff. They can.
Right, but I don't know if we're going to have a live stream going
probably
at this time.
Probably not live, no.
So we'll have probably plenty of stuff to download all throughout the week. So keep running those bash potters.
That's right.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much for listening. This is Atomic Opera with Make a God.
guy says the deliver date is on the 31st. Which means they better freaking be there.
It's over.
Yes.